United States versus Zepeda.
I'll wait for Mr. Nozick to be seated. I please the court, Robert Handelsman for Zepeda. And parole evidence of a sentence is admissible only when the oral pronouncement of that sentence itself is ambiguous. According to your decision in Burton, the oral pronouncement of a sentence is the moment when that sentence attaches. That moment is when the judge says what the term of commitment will be. And the judge here said 150 months, sentence attached. There's nothing ambiguous, vague, or uncertain when a judge says a sentence is 150 months. Burton says that the reasons given for the sentence cannot affect a substantive change from the one announced at the hearing. The two Fifth Circuit cases say that when there is a difference between the oral pronouncement of a sentence and a written judgment, that is a conflict, not an ambiguity. These are the legal principles you must apply here. The cases cited on pages 7 through 9 of the initial brief require the written version of the sentence to conform to the oral pronouncement, not the other way around, as the government is arguing.
The problem here is that the judge said conflicting things at the oral pronouncement of sentence, and at least arguably rendering the pronouncement of 150 months ambiguous in context, because the guidelines range was 210 months to 262 months. He said he was sentencing at the bottom of the range, and then he imposes a sentence of 150 months, which doesn't make any sense and under those circumstances, and nobody objects, and he offers to do the rereading, and everybody waives rereading. I almost question whether this transcript is correct, but I guess we have to assume it is.
There's a presumption the transcript is correct.
Right.
But all these other things that the judge said, other than 150 months, is basically parole evidence, because 150 months is clear. If the actual pronouncement of the sentence is ambiguous, like it was in the Augustino case, which is the one cited in the October 9th order, then you can consider all the other things. But when the actual pronouncement of the sentence is clear and unambiguous, as it was here, you can't look at those other things.
Well, is the pronouncement of the sentence just the number that the judge utters, or is it everything the judge says at the sentencing hearing?
Well, according to Burton, anything else that's done cannot affect the substantive change from the sentence.
Anything else that's done afterward, right? Not during the course of the actual pronouncement of the sentence?
All of that, the explanations are not the pronouncement of sentence. When a judge says 150 months, that's the sentence. And if he made a mistake, well, we're all stuck with it. That's what the case law says. The Eskridge case specifically says that. If he makes a mistake, it can't be changed, even if it's erroneous. The only two exceptions for that would be if the sentence itself is ambiguous, like it was in an Agostino case, or maybe it was above the maximum or below the minimum. Other than that, you can't have, that's it. I mean, the Burton case is, I think, all you need to find a mistake here. The Munoz de la Rosa case, cited in the initial brief from the Ninth Circuit, where the government attempted to use Rule 35 or Rule 36 to make the oral pronouncement conform to the written judgment, and the Court of Appeals said, no, you can't do it. It's the written judgment that has to conform to the oral pronouncement. And if that oral pronouncement is clear, as it was here, 150 months, we're all bound by it. I would submit to you that if we had the flip side of these facts, the judge said the sentence was 210 months and then said it should be a below-guideline sentence, and the written judgment said 150 months, the government wouldn't be here asking for a remand for clarification. It would be arguing that the oral pronouncement was unambiguous and controlling, and a written judgment should be conformed to it. And the government would be correct under those circumstances.
Well, I think under those circumstances, the defense attorney would have spoken up at the hearing.
Well, you know, I didn't even catch it when I did the Anders brief on this. I mean, I think you were on the panel that did the October 9th order. I didn't catch it. The judge didn't catch it. His clerks didn't catch it. His secretary didn't catch it. Mr. Nozick didn't catch it. The defense attorney didn't catch it. It's a good thing we have a court of last resort here.
Well, that always brings it into question whether it was directly transcribed if nobody caught it. That's an interesting – it's not an issue here. But it is later that that he goes into this same thing. Maybe this is why you didn't catch it. He says the reasons for imposing a sentence are as follows. The guideline range is 210 to 262. The court is imposing a sentence at the bottom end of the guidelines because of what the court determines to be a fair sentence. I guess that's what sort of makes this confusing or at least ambiguous as opposed to just... I see what you're saying. You know, it says here after he goes through that dissertation, and then it's a couple pages later. I don't know if he said anything before that. Is there something earlier that, you know, that's the government?
I don't.
He talked about guidelines and considering all that stuff.
Well, the initial brief mentions the government has a right to take this back to the district court and have an evidentiary hearing as to whether the court reporter got it correct or made a mistake. But they're under the Court Reporters Act, there's a presumption that the transcript is accurate. So the burden is the government's to show that it's not accurate. Now, maybe the court reporter has some notes. I don't know. We've asked that if you do send it back for a hearing, that you apply Rule 36 because Judge Lozano may have some notes that he may want to waive the privilege on. I don't know. We're only working for what we have here. And what we have here, when he says 150 months, that's clear. Not like Agostino, where the pronouncement itself was ambiguous. You know, fortunately, situations don't come up very often. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is David Nozick. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Indiana.
Did you prosecute this case?
I did. And the first thing I was going to say, Your Honor, is that unlike Mr. Handelsman, who could say, I just got this on appeal, I perhaps might be guilty of being asleep at the switch when the pronouncement was read. I have no recollection of it. As defense counsel pointed out, no one in the entire court caught it. It could have been a typographical error. I can't stand here and say that it was. But an entire courtroom, clerks, deputies, CSOs, defense counsel, myself, it was not caught by anyone.
Does the court reporter use a recording device to supplement the stenotype?
My belief is she does, Your Honor, or he does, Your Honor, but I cannot say with certainty. The government disagrees, of course, with the defense's arguments. I believe, the government believes, that if the defendant walks away with a sentence other than what the Honorable Judge Lozano intended, it's a miscarriage of justice. So a five-year sway shouldn't be determined by either a scrivener's error or a typographical error by the court reporter or by a slip of the tongue. We're talking about a five-year difference. Now, the defense counsel, Mr. Handelman, argues there's no ambiguity, but clearly there is, because Judge Lozano says over and over and over, I'm denying this argument, you know, for a downward departure. I'm denying that argument. All the 3553 issues, the defendant's age, his diabetes. He makes incredibly clear that he is denying the arguments.
Are there cases from the Seventh Circuit that speak to whether or not this is subject to a remand?
Well, Judge, the case that we cited is when an orally pronounced sentence is ambiguous, the judgment commitment order is evidence which may be used to determine the intended sentence. I believe this court judge could just simply look at the entirety of the transcript and deny the defendant's appeal. I did not find any cases say that specifically in this instance it could be remanded, but I believe certainly if there's ambiguity, this honorable court could.
Well, my question, I guess, is are there cases that say we can't remand?
I'm sorry, can or cannot?
Cannot remand it.
I have not found any on point, Your Honor.
Does the ambiguity rule apply to the precise pronouncement of sentence that is the number of years, or does it apply more broadly to the judge's statement of reasons?
I would argue more broadly. Mr. Handelman seems to argue that simply the digits, when those digits are being spoken, that's the entire sentence, and everything else, you know, is sort of collateral matters. It's not. He said, the judge says, I am giving you the bottom of the guidelines. And then he says the wrong number. So it is ambiguous. I don't believe the pronouncement of sentence is simply him reciting the number. It's the entire pronouncement of the sentence. It's the court costs. It's the supervised release term. It is the fine. It's the entire sentence as read. And he says, I am giving you the bottom of the guidelines.
Including that statement of justification or reasons? That
exactly, Your Honor.
That's part of the pronouncement of sentence. Is there any law to support that?
I believe so. Judge, I apologize. Not that I have at the tip of my tongue or in the brief. The government's belief is that it is well within your power to remand.
Well, we do Palladino remands to ask the judge if he or she would have given the same sentence based on what the understanding of the sentencing guidelines are, which is not directly the same, but.
Understood, Judge. It was my belief, and I should have provided case law, but it's my belief that when there's an ambiguity, that the court can clarify their sentence and explain the reasons for sentence. I've had cases remanded for a number of reasons, never for this specific one, but to explain sentencing issues, to lay more record for why the district court judge did various things. I believe this would be.
That's why I was asking if there are cases which prohibit us in the Seventh Circuit. Counsel's cited Ninth Circuit case, which seems to say that.
But. Not that I found on point. And I don't believe that, respectfully, I don't believe that the Ninth Circuit cases forbid it. Those cases focus on if there's no ambiguity. I mean, I think the case law is clear. When there's an ambiguity, then this court has different options.
Well, is that part that I read there? Good. Page 29, where he says 150, and it's over in page 32, with court sort of in a rehash, I guess. Is the reason for imposing the sentence as follows. And the guideline range in this case is 210 to 262, and the court is imposing the sentence at the bottom end of the guidelines because of what the court determines to be a fair sentence. Now, that's where that creates the conflict. I don't know what, and there are other things that may be internally conflicting, but that's where at least numbers are used in the same sentence. He's at 210 at the bottom, and he's sentencing at the bottom.
Correct, Judge. That's why the government believes there's an ambiguity.
Well, yeah, I guess so. But it is, I guess the only thing, it's like any kind of a ratcheting thing. It's not a good analogy, but it's like a double jeopardy, where once you seat the jury and you don't go through some things, if a mistake's made, the prosecution may be out of luck. I just wondered if there's some precedent for that where, he precisely states this, that now we can't back up and say, well, that's what he meant to do. Maybe we should, but I just want to make sure there's not some reason why we can't.
Judge, I don't see any, I've not found case law to the contrary. The defense counsel has not cited case law from the Seventh Circuit, which says that you can't. Government's position, as argued, is to avoid miscarriage of justice, you can, because of the ambiguity.
Well, obviously, if it were 150 and the bottom of the guidelines was 75 or something, that's not the number 70, then that mistake would certainly create ambiguity.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you just inverted the figures here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Put 210 and 150 in the other place. So I guess that's one way of looking at it.
Right. And I mean, again, I would urge the court to look at the entirety of the transcript. It's not simply him saying, I'm giving you the bottom of the guidelines or bottom end of the guidelines. He clearly goes through the 3553 issues one by one and rejects sort of all of those, all for pleas for sympathy, his age, his illness, and makes abundantly clear that he's denying her request for a downward departure or a non-guideline sentence. This honorable court has no more questions. I'd rely on my brief.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Handelman have? 3 minutes.
I think all you need to do is look at the Burton case, where the reasons for the sentence came a month or two later. The court said that the reasons given for the sentence cannot affect the substantive change from the one announced at the hearing. Let's say, God forbid, hypothetically, Judge Lozano had a heart attack after he finished stating on page 30, it is further ordered defendant shall pay a special assessment of $100. And he couldn't say anything more. Nobody here would say he didn't pronounce a sentence. That is the sentence. When he finished there, when he finished mentioning on page 30 about the special assessment, he pronounced the sentence. And whatever else he said after that, or even before that, is not, under your decision in Burton, the sentence.
This seems to me to be an argument in favor of judges stating their reasons before they pronounce sentence instead of the other way around. I've never understood why it's done this way.
I can't help you on that.
Because then maybe people would notice discrepancies and inconsistencies.
Well, then there's an issue if you could still have the same problem that way, too.
But it's less likely that it would be overlooked.
Well, the point I want to make here is when the judge says what the term of commitment will be, the supervised release, special assessment, that's the sentence. Anything else he says outside of that is not the sentence. No different in a contract case where you have a contract that's clear on its face and somebody comes in with parole evidence. What counsel is asking you to look at is essentially parole evidence. We'd ask you to just rely on the Burton case for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanselman. Thank you for taking this case by appointment and representing your client very well.